And we're back! Welcome, Mike, and Oscar. Once again, getting you through this Oscar sprint. We're doing our best to hammer out these single-serving episodes, one episode to one nominated movie.
A lot of great movies, a lot of movies being nominated, a bigger number of nominated movies than in years past. The last 2 years, there was 16 each year, 17 each year for the Oscars, and this year we already got like 20 for the Globes. It's going to be a bunch of movies and a bunch of profiles.
Lucky us.
From
right?
us.
But for doing our first year.
Why are we speaking like this? I thought we were going to do this entire episode in a Scottish brogue.
You go fire the, well, we have to enlist first in the army, and then, you know, we got to fight for our country. That's what we're doing. We're doing Dunkirk today, as well as my long way of saying what we're getting at.
So it's just Harry Styles, wall to wall.
That's right. We're just going to play What Makes You Beautiful for a couple hours, and then we'll hit stop. But Dunkirk is
that one of his songs? Sorry, I didn't give you.
Don't you fake like you don't know One Direction?
I don't know if that's one of his songs. Sorry.
He did That's Amore. Yeah, that's one of his.
That's Amore. Okay. yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, but Dunkirk is the Christopher Nolan war epic.
It's a joke for all of our grandparents.
Yeah.
They're big in the podcasting right now.
That's right. Yeah, they just learned how to hit play. Dunkirk is what we're doing today on the Mike, and Oscar Sprint Profile. And it's a Chris Nolan. It's an epic. It's a war movie. It's Harry Styles' acting debut, like you just said.
It was like the number one contender for the longest time. I think we got a lot of, you know, based on awards results up to now in the awards season, we have a lot of other movies kind of stepping up to it. You know, the Lady Birds, the Call Me By Your Names, Get Out's won some best pictures. We'll be talking about
soon. We're going to touch on the ramifications it's had on Nolan, but Nolan was viewed as a heavy favorite for the director and kind of being taken down a peg or two lately. It's weird.
I wonder if this is like our second episode, 1997, where it was L.A. Confidential for a while and Titanic came out, and then everybody's like, wait a minute, Titanic, this is a once-in-a-generation type of movie. We got to put it up there for it. Now, Nolan's performance here as a director is something that I don't think you can ignore. And yeah, this is one of those, the best PG-13 war movie that I've ever seen.
It's probably up there with some of the greats, which we'll list, you know, the pantheon of war movies. But let's get into it like we always do. Again, this is an Oscar Sprint Profile episode.
If you guys listen,
or Appleseed. If you guys listen to the ones we've already released, such as The Disaster Artist, we're going to give you a non-spoiler section first. We're going to talk about the production profile, the specs of the movie, the box office numbers, all the information in the world you could possibly want going into the movie. And then we're going to have a 40-second breakdown, which is a Mike One exclusive track that we're going to enter for Grammy nomination, I think.
You missed your call. You should have been a jingle writer in the 1960s.
What an absurd jingle that is.
If I ever watch Broadcast News again, shout out to the 1987 Best Actress pod, I'm pitching a lot of callbacks.
You're
a true
episodes. Company, man.
Yes. I expect you to show up in, you know, the jingle writers with the little tiny keyboard and the keyboard tie.
It's going to be me. I'm going to be the spiritual successor to Weird Al.
Who was
someday.
A jingle writer in a sitcom histories? Was John Stamos in Full House a jingle writer?
I think the most famous one is Charlie, what's his name from Two and a Half Men, Charlie Sheen's character.
Right.
He was, debaucher and a womanizer and then ultimately lost his mind. So I'm on that track. So again, after that jingle, we're going to have a spoiler section for another 10, 15 minutes, tell you all everything you need to know about the entirety of the movie. So if you have not yet seen Dunkirk, you want to check out this first 45, 50. We're going to set you up, hopefully get you hyped to see it. If you've seen it, you want to know our takes on the whole plot and the twists and turns that happen. That'll be in the spoiler section coming up after the break. And we will let you know when that is in both the show notes and via audio clue. So let's get into it right now. Mike's going to start us off with a production profile for Dunkirk. What do we have?
I'm beginning with the story Inception, pun intended, Nolan's connection to the film and the story of the pre-production process. So Christopher Nolan and his wife / mother of his four children and filmmaking partner / career producer, Emma Thomas.
A lot of hats.
So yeah, I mean the Alma Hitchcock to Christopher Nolan's career.
And
here.
God bless career women like that. God bless women in general, because they're obviously the more sane and stable gender right now in Hollywood. But God bless
as
career.
We learned in Star Wars.
Yeah, yes. But God, I mean, you know, good props to her wearing all those hats and good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, just an amazing filmography from her standpoint, and yeah, four kids during her, you know, rearing of four kids. I don't know if that's a term. I don't know kids. Nolan and Thomas conceived the idea for the movie back in the 1990s when they were college students together. They took kind of a day trip and sailed across the English Channel to and from Dunkirk. Nolan was sitting on this idea for a long while. I want to read a quote from Nolan at the beginning of this profile that I think summarizes his laser focus. And here it is, quote unquote, "The empathy for the characters have nothing to do with their story. I did not want to go through the dialogue, tell the story of my characters. The problem is not who they are, who they pretend to be, or where they come from. The only question I was interested in was, will they get out of it?" So that quote was atop the Wikipedia page for the movie. I'm surprised at how
mission succeeded there.
Right. So that's you know, donate to Wikipedia again, folks. They are freaking awesome. So Nolan originally wanted to improvise the entire script during production, but Emma Thompson convinced him otherwise. So Nolan found this happy medium. He wrote a 76-page script, which is like, you know, 45 pages light for a typical two-hour movie.
I was going to say about 45 pages of scenery set up, too, probably.
Right. So there's not a lot of dialogue in that script either. So it means must have been a thick read. I mean, one of those reads that takes a while. But however, I haven't read the script yet. I usually try to, you know, glance at a few of the Oscar movie
You're
scripts
so professional.
Online. But I didn't haven't yet done so. Maybe that'll be a, you know, Mike. That'll be a whole new podcast right there.
Yeah, it's going to be you. It's going to just be called Mike.
Mic'd up? No.
It's available now.
Oh, it is available now. Yeah. Anyway, he writes a 76-pager and gives it a trademark Nolan feel where he just has a timeline and it just hops all over the place, manipulating the plot.
Yeah, McConaughey wasn't talking about Christopher Nolan when he said time was a flat circle in True Detective Season 1, I don't think.
But maybe Nolan gave him that speech during their production time with Interstellar.
Or maybe he put it in his head in a dream that McConaughey once had. I don't know, I've gone cross-eyed.
Nolan has quite the filmography, folks. So this is
this is
a cool director of from our childhood. I mean,
one of the greatest directors probably of the last 25 years, without question.
You know, from The Prestige and Memento, which we watched during our college years, to The Dark Knight trilogy, to Inception, even Interstellar has its moments, I would say. But
imagine coming out of the gate hot with Memento being one of your first like full films.
I mean, I loved that movie upon rewatch this past year. I mean, it was awesome.
It's outstanding. It's an outstanding.
I watched that in my junior year English class in high school.
I went to the wrong school. You've seen all these movies throughout your life in the school system, and I got like Stand and Deliver.
You saw Bambi.
Yeah. Like you've got nothing.
Well, I tell you,
The Miracle Worker was a big one for us. The water, yeah.
I've never seen that.
The Helen Keller one.
Really?
Yeah.
Who's in that?
She won the Oscar for it. I
Whoopi
should know
Goldberg.
That. Maybe if I ever do an Oscar pods, I'll look that up.
We went to different schools, I guess. So anyway, this script has three plot lines to it. The Mole, which is not code name for a spy. It's not code name for a spy that changes sides. It is referring to the harbor, the Stone Harbor at Dunkirk, which is basically, you know, what forms the port of Dunkirk. So it's the beaches storyline, the Mole.
It was also a great reality show on ABC back in the early 2000s. My mother and I used to watch it fanatically. I wish they would bring it back. I tweet them probably twice a month about bringing back the Mole. This is a personal problem. Anderson Cooper started on the Mole. He was actually the host of the first two seasons of the Mole. It was great primetime appointment viewing, and then they just took it away.
Just brand gesture for me right now. I mean, that ranks up there with your Dill Pickles.
Man, race. I miss the Mole. It was a great fucking show.
All right, I take
what are we
your
talking about?
So the Mole plotline took the place over a week's time, and this will line up with history as we talk about the evacuation going from May 24th to early June, which was about 8 days to a week. The sea storyline, so they go by land, by air, by sea. The sea storyline with Mark Rylance takes place over a day. I think in the movie they say something like 4 hours. The air plotline takes place over a single hour with Tom Hardy involved in that one.
And it plays out in real time too. It's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I love the structure of this script. We're going to have a whole lot more on that, especially in spoilers. Nolan and Thomas approach their pre-production research as though they were about to shoot a documentary. One of the major attractions to the project for Nolan was that the film seemed to invert Hollywood formulas. In my opinion, I'd say that he just had a laser focus on articulating the language of a suspense movie, like I started off with. But this has worked extremely well for war films in the past, like The Hurt Locker, and it pays big dividends here. But and look no further than the Hans Zimmer score, which is just built from the single tick of a clock.
Arguably the best part of this movie, which is saying a lot.
From Nolan's one of his family heirlooms, a tick of one of his old watches passed down from his grandparents.
How about that?
He gave that sound to Zimmer to create the whole script. But anyway, more on that later. The pre-production process,
I spent the last 5
though,
minutes over here thinking about The Mole on ABC.
Yeah, but the pre-production process...
I'm a sick man.
The pre-production process was cool to research here because not only is Nolan mining into the actual history and all the technical aspects of the war, because they are rebuilding the ships. They are reconfiguring the airplanes that they take from the museum. And
I need to know when these visionary directors like Cameron, we touched on Titanic, but James Cameron, when he was doing Titanic, he wanted to rebuild the whole structure. Nolan here, it's like you go to these studios and like, all right, what's your idea for this film? Well, I want to completely remake a 1940s war battlefield authentically.
Yeah, I mean, I want to rebuild the city of Pompeii and blow it up.
Yeah,
I want to rebuild the Titanic and then break it in half.
Write this man a check.
Yeah, I mean, Nolan rebuilds or basically takes, a lot of the planes, the Spitfires from the museum that I'll talk about later, and, creates planes and builds them from scratch that have two cockpits.
And we hype up Wikipedia a lot on this show because obviously it's a universally beloved tool, especially by us. But if you go to the Dunkirk Wikipedia page, they have the highlights to all the different types of aircraft that Nolan rebuilt and the different ships that were used involved in this.
Let me see. Have I gone there? Internet research?
It's fascinating to see, exactly the German Spitfire plane and the different types of ships that were used in this. It's fascinating to click on those links and just, you get definitely gut lost in a rabbit hole.
Absolutely. There's a ton of great internet research for it, and that's why this production profile is going to go on and on and on and on and on.
That's all right. Anyway. Let me explain to you the concept of the mole, all right? So we had one guy.
The mole is an animal, correct? A mammal?
Yeah, it was 8 people hired off the street to chase a mole around a yard.
Yeah, so that was strange.
That was strange. That was strange. A non sequitur.
So listen, Nolan and Thomas approached their pre-production research as though it was to shoot a documentary, like I said, and then we went off on the tangent of all time in terms of the war recreations that they had to make. But they also researched the hell out of, movies, suspense movies, and they screened a ton of suspense films for their cast and crew before production. I talked about this in my last miniature production profile in our first episode, but I want to highlight a couple films for this. The Wages of Fear, Alien, Unstoppable, and The Battle of Algiers are among the suspense movies he showed to his cast and crew.
You can definitely see some of the influences at certain points.
That Clouseau film. If you haven't seen The Wages of Fear and you're in a patient, I'm going to watch a foreign film mode. Like, it's again, foreign films, you can't watch with your laptop open. You have to kind of just say, I'm just going to watch the movie. That's one of my favorites, but it's also one of the fast, if you don't watch a lot of foreign films or don't watch a lot of black and white movies, that's one that go towards any taste, I would say. Anyway, Nolan and Thomas they did a deep dive over the years. I mean, they really feel, I feel like they really prepared almost their whole careers for this movie.
It's that, I mean, and we talked about this again with the James Franco disaster. I mean, you could tell, and the Academy's kind of shifting this way in terms of nominees, these passion projects that these auteurs stand behind and like have worked their whole lives to try and get the rights to and produce and show to the big screen. You can tell that the love that they're handled with, and it you could see the ideas have been festering in there a long time because the minute details are displayed perfectly.
Yeah, there's also, like I said, a laser focus in terms of the script, but they knew exactly how they wanted to show the antagonism, the German troops, in this movie, and it was by not showing them. They made a decision very early on in the pre-production process, you know, to show a few of the German dive bombers, to show torpedoes being fired, but not, obviously, the U-boats. This is not a good versus evil matchup. Necessarily, they didn't go into the Battle of Dunkirk, which preceded the evacuation. So they're basically showing their protagonist on the run, or one or two conflicts in the air, but they're not showing German soldiers or German troops till the very end.
Yeah, it's strictly about the psychology of war, right, and its effect on one side.
That
it's
fear of the unknown of chase movies, that monster that you don't show for the first hour of a monster mm-hmm. movie, that's what's kind of mm-hmm. involved in this one. And it works as a device for a suspense movie as well. I'm going to get into the cast and crew a little bit right now and give you some miniature profiles of the three protagonists, in my opinion, the three protagonists of these three storylines. Again, the Mole storyline, the Beaches Harbor storyline, is Fionn Whitehead being put as a protagonist. This actor is 21 years old now. And
so we hate him.
Yeah, he's crushing it.
He's very good looking, very successful, and he can go right to hell.
This was his first major feature film.
Again, die.
Growing up, Whitehead wanted to be a guitarist, rugby player, or breakdancer. So this, I don't know where
and
they're
he settled on Hollywood Big Shot.
Yeah, I don't know where they're getting. It's like me wanting to be an astronaut, NFL star, or yeah.
Our Wikipedia pages will be much, much sadder.
Or a podcast. Yeah. Whitehead was working in a coffee shop in 2015. So 2 years ago, this dude was a barista.
So it's the script from La La Land, except he's Emma Stone.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, very quickly becoming this, you know, one of the biggest movie stars, or in one of the biggest movies in the world. Yeah, I mean, a British miniseries called Him, anyway, casts Fionn Whitehead before he gets the surprise of his life when Nolan casts him a few months later in Dunkirk. He does have the perfect look, I would say, for that little rabbit that's being chased around by the hounds the whole movie.
That's another underrated part of any of Nolan's movies, I think. I mean, if you go back to the Batman trilogies, his casting is, I mean, he finds the little niche parts.
Yes.
The paranoia in Joe Pantoliano and Memento.
Right.
The hidden anger in Aaron Eckhart and Two-Face. You know, he finds these little niches that these guys can do and just puts them in full force and puts them right out in front. And they kill it every time.
Yeah, you're right. He's got an impeccable eye for casting, or whoever he employs is an impeccable eye for casting. So Tom Hardy is the protagonist of the Air storyline. Again, this is 1 hour of actual time on the Dunkirk timeline. This man is the greatest masked actor of all recorded time. We talked about this a lot in our very first pod. From Bane in The Dark Knight Rises to how he manages to overcome and emote all of his decision-making only through the glass eye holes of his fighter pilot mask is just utterly astounding.
I'd like everyone to take note that these are two grown men talking about Tom Hardy's role as Bane, and you're not going to get an impression.
Wow, look at you. This is restraint.
Arm
right
Gotham's
there.
Rook.
No, you couldn't do it. You were joking. Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah, so
Phil. Yes, Tom Hardy acts better with his eyes than most people in Hollywood do with years of training.
With all of their instrument.
Yeah.
Sounding way too sexual.
Just dirty, filthy.
Just pour some cold water on ourselves here. Think about Tom Hardy. Goddamn handsome. Anyway, Hardy made his feature film debut in a little film called Black Hawk Down that we reviewed a
tiny,
while back.
Tiny film.
Didn't we say all the British actors of our generation got their debut?
Of any generation. I mean, everybody that's famous now is in that movie. That's their first role.
We reviewed it in the 2001. Yeah.
Best director pod. Go back and check that out.
Finish
Black Hawk
each
Down.
Other's
sandwiches.
Bronson, Layer Cake, Rock and Roller, Inception, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy,
underrated,
Warrior.
Underrated. Yeah. I mean,
Warrior, Mad Max, Fury Road, and The Revenant are my favorite Tom Hardy
Not underrated.
He's going to be Venom In the new Fox Marvel movie.
He has, like...
Sony Marvel, sorry.
These videos of him pumping himself up for the Venom role. Right. And they're, like, greater than any movie workout montage that I've ever seen. It's just, like, you watch those and you're like, all right, I'm both in love with Tom Hardy now and want to run through a wall.
He must work out. Anyway, he's also apparently one of the stormtroopers in the latest Star Wars movie.
Yeah, but who isn't, right?
Daniel Craig was in the first one.
Daniel Craig, Tom Hardy's in this one. Harry and William apparently have roles as stormtroopers.
So yeah, he's in The Last Jedi somewhere, so look for that Easter egg. Which, you know, we also reviewed that movie earlier in the week, so check that pod out. Look at me plugging our former
You're a company man.
I'm
taking offers from other podcasts, and you're over here. No.
Mark Rylance is the biggest name actor in the C storyline. Debatable if he's the protagonist in that or if he's the mentor character in that plot line.
Responsible for one of the biggest upsets in recent Oscars history, taking the Academy Award away from Sly Stallone's Return in Creed.
Sly Stallone's crying in the locker room. Did not follow through with the Academy voters.
No.
Mark Rylance's Deadeye stare and, you know,
a talented muttering. Man, no doubt.
Yeah, he was great in that. I don't know if he's a protagonist again in this plot line. His son may carry the climax decision, but he's definitely the draw in those scenes, and he's got some of the biggest emotional moments. Oddly enough, Rylance grew up in, guess where?
The outskirts of Baghdad.
He grew up in Connecticut, man.
Close. I was close.
You were close. And then Wisconsin, he actually attended the University of Milwaukee. He immigrated from England with his parents and then went back to England with his parents because he was an artist and had to still kind of live with them.
Rylance is a very, you know, you belong in England with that kind of name. It's a very proper.
Oh, yeah. And he sounds like he comes from Ireland or Scotland or one of those ponds. Anyway, Rylance acted in a few...
Our country is burning.
Rylance acted in a few bit movie parts after doing a ton of English theater post-college, but he mostly worked in theater and British television in the 90s and 2000s. He finally, you know, hits kind of the height of his theater actor days, winning Tony Awards in 2009 before finally getting some traction as a movie actor. Of course, he spends about 5 years doing bit parts and bigger parts in Hollywood before he wins the 2016 Best Supporting Actor for his performance in The Bridge of Spies.
His first one, yep.
So I didn't go too... Anyway. Dunkirk also stars Kenneth Branagh.
Kenneth Branagh!
Good job. Cillian Murphy...
Cillian Murphy, scarecrow
from every Irish movie ever made.
It's nice in
Winds
Free,
Beneath the Barley,
Free Fire, which before it came out had a little Oscar momentum back in May. You know, it's nice to see Cillian Murphy play Irish when he can and just let his whole accent go. And boy, does he let it go in that movie!
Yeah, he's in a lot of good Neil Jordan movies. Tom Glenn Carney, who sounds like he should be in a lot of Neil Jordan movies, up and comer actor Jack Lowden, him and Carney, and Yuren Bonald. James Darcy.
So many great names. I don't care if they're stage names or real names. Barry, these people should be actors.
Barry Keoghan or Keoghan, who was I just saw in The Killing of a Sacred Deer. He's very good in that, although that movie...
Let's get a two-second review of Killing of a Sacred Deer from Mike. That was your two-second review of Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Somebody called Harry Styles is in this movie.
Not familiar.
And guess whose voice is in this one, Mikey?
Lily Tomlin.
Close. Michael Caine.
I'm getting there, man.
It was Steve Coogan playing Michael Caine.
One of the two.
But he's the voice over the fighter pilot radio that Tom Hardy's listening to. So I'm going to get into some production notes now. Again, this is a total rabbit hole, the Dunkirk production
profile.
Yeah,
you could definitely, if you ever find yourself, if you watch this movie, you get all hyped up for war and you want to research this online, you will find yourself down a rabbit hole. It's one of those you'll look up and 3 hours have passed.
As evidenced by the, we're going to keep going. I got a lot of nuggets here. So I got a lot of nuggets and spoilers as well.
Chicken nuggets?
Denver nuggets? I stole your joke.
I would never do that to you.
Listen to our first pod, folks. All 47 hours of it.
It was about this movie, as a matter of fact.
Yes, sir.
Are we getting off track too much today, you think?
I think we are.
Yeah, a little bit.
Despite all the logistical challenges, Nolan and Warner Brothers agreed to film the movie on location at Dunkirk. So this is the place, man. They discarded any other sites as alternatives. Suffolk or Suffield or someplace else was being looked at as the setting for the film, but they wanted to film
the tried and true area.
The rumors on Nolan's landmark deal, $20 million up front and 20% of the gross, given to him after the box office, that's been countered a bit. That was something I said in my original profile back on episode one. We don't know, but Variety has since reported that his initial upfront salary was cut drastically and a bigger percentage was tacked on at the end.
I think it worked out for him.
It worked out, yeah. This one made some money. Anyway, principal photography began on May 23rd, the anniversary of the fateful pause, which I'll get into in spoilers, the fateful pause between the Battle of Dunkirk and the evacuation. So that is some significant historical... That has some historical significance, and like I said, I'll go into further detail later. Shooting times were determined by the tides over the mole. Yes, so French labor strikes also affected production, but still they charged in to minimize the use of CG. He went practical effects for every single thing humanly possible.
It looks better.
But he, to the point where he used not only miniatures, but cardboard cutouts of soldiers.
Wow.
To show the...
It looks great. I mean, it looks fantastic on screen.
Even still, there were 6,000 extras used on this movie. And now we get into some of the fun stats for all you gearheads out there. Again, most of the footage, stunts, boats, and planes were built or reconstructed from real-life vessels.
Unbelievable.
Aircraft. Nearly 60 ships were used, and the aircraft were built with dual cockpits.
How do you even get all this shit to the set? Like, how do you get what you need for this to shoot at Dunkirk to the set?
Other boats? Other ships? I don't know.
Good other Lord.
The chicken and the egg. Anyway, dual cockpits, one for the pilots and one for the cameramen / real pilots. So one for the actors, one for the people doing it. Kind of like our driving instructor days where he had the real brake and he used it on me. I failed my first driver's test. I'm sorry, folks. I'm great now. I drive very
I feel
well
like
you
should be playing some sad music. Deep introspection.
Spitfire. Yeah, this is our tragic upbringing. These guys fought a freaking war.
Yeah, right? Like I said, little dichotomy
yeah,
for you.
Spitfire planes were actually provided and rebuilt from the Imperial War Museum of Duxford.
What can you even say about stuff like that? Like, no, I mean, and the budget actually wasn't, too unreasonable for a Christopher Nolan war epic.
Right.
But to see the work and the practical work he put into all this is just...
Knows how to stretch a dime.
I guess so. Oh, just amazing.
Don't go to war with Christopher Nolan because he'll win.
That's the underlying message of this episode.
If war film directors actually went to actual war with one another, Christopher Nolan's money would go longer.
Somehow I just don't see our president calling him up for references.
The film was shot entirely in IMAX, 65mm and 65mm large format film stock, and more IMAX footage was shot in this film than any of the Nolan and Thomas previous filmography.
Now, you saw this one in IMAX, correct?
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Yeah. Especially the stuff in the air was just like, oh my God,
like
I'm getting
on
vertigo.
A roller coaster, yeah.
It's totally amazing. I haven't been that up high in a movie theater since like Avatar, because Avatar did a great job.
And you had like a life-size Tom Hardy to talk to.
Yes.
It's going to be okay, Tommy. Keep flying, Tommy.
Listen, the sparsity of dialogue made, all this use of IMAX cameras possible because those cameras are known to be very noisy and they don't really pick up sound well yet. I mean, they pick it up well, but they're just very noisy in their own right.
How many of them do you think Tommy Wiseau owns?
Listen to our disaster artist profile, folks. We take this moment for our sponsors, us.
Waxing poetic.
I'm going to get into some critical reception.
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's see how this war movie was received across the bow. Pretty high, right? I mean, critics seem to have an affinity for it, if just for Hans Zimmer's score and Christopher Nolan's work.
92% on Rotten Tomatoes, 8.6 out of 10 critic score, which is very high for Rotten Tomatoes.
If you hear our other pods where we go into some Rotten Tomatoes stuff, you know, we tell you not to live and die by the tomato meter, but the audience score, the critical reception, it does tell you a decent amount. And there's some big movies out there, I'll tease a little bit, but there's some big movies out there that have not scored well either with the critics or with the audience.
Yeah, not to that number. And 82% with the audiences, but again, a 4 out of 5, which is very high.
Great. Those are great scores.
You know, the film was released, and this is why we're recording the podcast now. The film was released on DVD and Blu-ray and for rent on VOD December 19th. I would say, to finish up critical reception, Metacritic, 94 out of 100.
It's basically a clean sweep of all the major critic awards. If you have the audience score, the tomato critic score, you have the Metacritic score that high.
Dude, that's the highest Metacritic number
way
I've seen
there.
For any movie
way
we've looked
up
at.
There.
94 out of 100. Anyway, I'll get into awards. Mike's going to take more of the specs, but in terms of the awards projections, I'll take those. All 26 experts on goldderby.com, a site that we really love to frequent, on goldderby.com have Dunkirk in their top 10 for best picture. 9 critics have it at number 1. This was a much bigger number during our first pod, and now it's down to 9. Like I said, a lot of horses have entered the race. All 26 experts also have Christopher Nolan in their top 5 for Best Director. That typically signals that if you're a Best Director nom, you're going to have a Best Picture,
nomination
as well. Right. And he won the Golden Globe that year, weirdly enough. Anyway, 15 of the experts have Nolan winning for Best Director.
Which is ironic because his critical, the awards, the Critics Circle awards that have been coming out, he has not been doing remarkably well. But right. I'll get into that.
3 of 26 experts still have Rylance in their top 5 for Best Supporting Actor, but he's kind of fallen off.
Would surprise me, I would say. It would surprise me if he made the cut.
So, yeah, I'm going to throw it over to you, Mike. What's your name?
That's the part you screwed up.
What's your name again? We have to keep that blooper in. I'm an asshole. Anyway, throwing it over to you, Mike.
I suck at segues. Literally is your name. It's the name of the podcast. It's on your license.
That was like take 3. Mike.
Anyway.
N to the M.
Mike, Ken, and Oscar.
Oh, my God.
Dunkirk was released. The first showing was July 13th at the Odeon Leicester Square over in the UK, released 7/19 in France, July 20th in the Netherlands, and finally came to the US and wide in the UK at July 21st. Warner Brothers was the distributors of the project. It was written and directed by Christopher Nolan, as we said. Had a $100 million budget, ended up grossing to this date $525.2 million worldwide. That splits down to $188 million domestically with a $337.2 million draw internationally.
Can you get on my calculator? Calculate his Christopher Nolan's percentages?
Doing all right for him. 11th highest domestic grossing film of the year, 15th highest for the worldwide scale. Episode 1, which was our first episode of Mike and Oscar, we said that it was an 8.4 on IMDb, which had it tied for 51st in the top 250. It has since dropped all the way down to an 8.2 on 268,000 plus reviews.
So I gave you Rotten Tomatoes. Mike's giving you the IMDb profile.
All sides of all the coins here. Good for 141st on the IMDb top 250. In reality, it's tied for 108th.
Wow.
So it's up there. It's definitely, like we said, and Mike alluded to, and we're hammering home here, it's critically received very highly, very well. Some award-centric notables, as we said, we'll get into the Critics Circles and the AFIs. As it's the end of the year, they like giving out all their awards. It's on the AFI top 10 list for the top films of 2017 year. We tell you that a lot of podcasts, but every year AFI deems their top 10 movies. This was one of the 10. They don't rank them. They just give you the setting of 10.
Episode 13 of Mike Magnaski.
It did receive 3 Golden Globe nominations for original score, go figure, Best Director, and Best Picture Drama. But it has a lone SAG award, a Screen Actors Guild nomination for Outstanding Action Performance by a Stunt Ensemble. But I guess that's what you get when you have an A-list director produces an A-list film with an A-list cast and you don't provide much dialogue at all for them to perform on. So, Stunt. Best Stunt is the only SAG award that Dunkirk has been. All right.
It's surprising because I know the performances are smaller, but they're still of high quality.
Yeah, so, yeah. I'm surprised to see that. Critics' Choice Award is a heavy favorite in terms of noms. It's nominated in 8 categories: Best Editing, Best Score, Best Production Design, Best Visual Effects, Best Cinematography, Best Director, Best Picture, and Best Ensemble. So
here's an interesting tidbit. awardcircuit.com in their podcast Circuit Breaker, they were saying that no movie has ever won Best Picture without at least being nominated in one of the actor categories, one of the top four actor categories. I think that was the stat they mentioned. And now we have a lot of our, you know, the cast of this movie kind of falling out. Mark
Rylance. Well, this is very much, yeah, I mean, it's very much a not, you know, there's no dialogue. How can, I mean, you know, the most of the acting was done by, like you said, Tom Hardy's eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be tough to get an acting nomination in any regard for this.
My best supporting actor right there, folks. He's so great.
In our first Mike and Oscar episode, we carried the torch for Nolan, like I said, being a big front runner. He has 13 total nominations for Best Director throughout all the various critic circles. Ranging from the big shows like the Golden Globes to critic circles such as the Phoenix Critics Circle, the Detroit Film Critics Society, and Seattle Film Critics Awards. But he's only won the category thus far on two occasions.
Wow.
The Chicago Film Critics Association Awards and the Washington, D.C. Area Film Critics Association Awards.
Dude, I thought the pros would just gaga for
him. Especially, and I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but especially with the lack of dialogue. Right. I mean, it's all in the directing in this
Thoroughly
film.
Cinematic.
Yeah, so I was very surprised to see that. You say it's doing well by Gold Derby standards. We'll see how it falls out, because again, not getting a whole lot of love on the critics circles, but it is nominated again, save for the SAG Awards and the big prelude to the Oscars.
Let's see what the Directors Guild of America has to say at the end of the day. Let's see what SAG has to say at the end of the day. I'm still curious, because once we start to get the actual professionals weighing in, not just the critics, I think this movie is going to come back front and center.
Which is why I was surprised to see it not get a SAG for Best Director, because you would think with all the big names Nolan has worked with in the field, people that want to work with him still, you know, and having such a unique take on this movie, I thought he would surely be nominated by the workers, but who knows?
Well, I guess the guilds, I would say, yeah, you're right. SAG is not going to tell us anything. We'll see what the guilds say.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Producers Guild, Writers Guild, Directors Guild.
The movie does start with a white type against a black screen. You see the young men walking through the streets of Dunkirk. The enemy have driven the British and French armies to the sea. Trapped at Dunkirk, they await their fate, hoping for deliverance, for a miracle. And that's basically with the setup that we have here going into this film. It's like we said, the Christopher Nolan war epic about the escape from the beaches of Dunkirk and people, the English troops trying to come home and trying to get out of harm's way, and the Germans having them pinned down and basically trying to wipe them out.
Yeah, we'll have more information during spoilers, but this is our non-spoiler review. I wanted to start off, Mike, saying, what were your expectations going into this thing?
Look, I mean, my exposure to Nolan prior to this was the Dark Knight trilogy, Memento. So when you have stuff like that, you're being told, okay, you're getting a Chris Nolan war epic, and Hans Zimmer is going to score it. Hmm. You know, like, okay. Just give it all the awards then.
That pool filter from the Dark Knight that they gave to the Joker, you know, that theme, that pool filter that you heard all summer is actually Joker's theme, and he makes that the most suspenseful thing you've ever heard in your life, right?
My expectations couldn't have been higher. This was an A movie for me all the way, whether it met it or not, I guess we'll get into, but...
Weirdly enough, my expectations were tempered because of Interstellar did not...
And I thought that was just a hiccup.
Yeah, that did not meet my expectations at all. I thought that was a hokey finish to that movie, even though it was a really cool setup.
Especially considering the hype for Interstellar, and there was some trade-offs going on between who would get the distribution rights for that between studios. Warner Brothers traded with another studio, and they were trading film rights back and forth. It was really weird, because they thought it was going to be a big moneymaker.
I mean, The Dark Knight Rises was kind of disappointing for me, even though I really enjoyed the end of that movie. I enjoyed scenes from that movie very, you know, a lot. Even still, it didn't live up to The Dark Knight. I think they wanted to make the third movie about the continuation of the Joker storyline. Unfortunately, Heath Ledger had to pass away. But yeah, I mean, that was as bloated a superhero epic as you're ever going to see, as bloated of a franchise movie as you're ever going to see. How many speeches does every character give in that movie? Interstellar was kind of similar. So I'm thinking after those two bloated Nolan movies that this is his approach to, you know, historical.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be even worse than an historical epic. I didn't even really look at the runtime of this movie. I just see Kenneth Branagh in all the trailers, you know, running his mouth like crazy. So I'm figuring it was going to be one long and excruciating speech after the next. But no, we get this Wages of Fear, just thorough exercise in suspense filmmaking from start to finish.
Pared down.
Too. And that was so thoroughly cinematic for me. I buy into the sparsity of dialogue. I buy into the plot line of one death trap after the next. I love that fact. And every time I watch this movie, I give it plus points. So, I mean, it's one of those movies you'll love to revisit if you're a film nerd. But just if you're craving a suspense movie, this is a PG-13 style one that you can watch with your parents. So that's hinting at my teaser review.
It's Full Metal Jacket in the way that, you know, you don't know what's going on. I mean, you could see the effects of war and the effects of what they're living through, having, you know, the mental drain on the characters, the main characters that are on screen, but you don't know how they're going to react to it. Like, are they going to go Private Pile and just snap mentally and blow their commander's head off? Are they going to try to, you know, is a hero going to emerge? Are people going to cower in fear? And you kind of get all of that in various ways in different scenes without giving too much away. It's the rewatchability of it is very high, like you said. And it's for everything that it doesn't have, it is still a Christopher Nolan war epic. So it's you're getting a solid movie, whether it meets your expectations.
I kind of feel like, you know, I'm realizing this just now. Again, podcasting kind of unlocks my brain in certain ways. I don't know how, but Christopher Nolan was kind of ready for this movie maybe before Interstellar. He should have did this movie before Interstellar. He was kind of ramping up to a serious movie after Inception, and obviously he tried to make The Dark Knight Rises maybe too serious. Why so serious there, Chris? You know, he tried to make Interstellar a mix between Spielberg and Kubrick, and it didn't quite land.
I think the two biggest takeaways from the movie, if not the directorial stuff, because I think it's just it's beautifully directed, because it has to have a passing grade with the type of movie it is. But the cinematography, the landscapes of all that, and the claustrophobia,
yes,
you know, that you feel as a viewer, an audience member of this movie, even
in contrast to
wide open beach,
doing on the beach. But never mind, in the air, I agree. That's
it's really amazingly done. That, I mean, the cinematography, I would say, and the score, obviously, by Hans Zimmer.
You're stuck in a tomb.
Yeah.
All right. In those ships, and you're in the wide open air with Tom Hardy, even though you're still stuck in that tiny cockpit,
little plane. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, we kind of wanted to talk about production values, folks. I mean, we hinted at some of it already. My big five in this one, we usually go sight to sound or sound to sight. You want to start with the sights, Mike?
Like I said, the cinematography is the biggest part of it for me. In that. You know, you keep hammering this feeling of suspense that he gives out, and it's really contrasted well by the overall, the high angle shots and the peering down at the beach, and you see how much land they have to operate with. And you, in your mind's eye, you're like, yeah, this is his wide open beach. How are these people so, you know, constrained? But they are. They're literally sitting ducks. Right. And that's actually one of the quotes in the movie early on.
One of the trailer scenes where the dive bombers are blowing up troops on the beach, as Fionn Whitehead covers his head like in the sand, and the bombs are hitting, you know, 100 meters away, 50 meters away.
Yeah, and you see them approaching, 25
meters away. That is, to me, like a signature shot and a signature, you know, style from Nolan. Definitely a selling point in terms of the marketing of this film. The cinematography, the editing, the production design of this movie is remarkable, and it's obviously enhanced by the real thing being shown, the real thing being remade and all that we mentioned.
But, and the feeling of dread that they're able to portray with the little dialogue there is, too. I mean, Kenneth Branagh saying that, you know, they only expect to save 10% of the 400,000 British that are there.
Yes.
You know, they tell you it's this feeling of gloom and doom, and you're
when
up against...
When something is said, it really goes far.
Yeah, I mean, it's used well, and it adds to the effect that you feel watching this of, these guys are screwed.
Yeah, so just to conclude, the look of this movie is amazing. It'll blow you away on the bigger screen, certainly blew me away on IMAX. I was a mouth breather for this entire film because I just couldn't, you know, undrop my jaw. In terms of the sounds of this movie, though, those bullets, if you rewatch this on your own home TV, those bullets will wake up, you know, wake you up. If you're watching this late at night. This is the worst going to sleep movie ever. We've talked about great going to sleep movies. This is the worst. You know, the gunshots early, the planes in the air, the sounds of screaming and dying soldiers. You know, some of these will really haunt you, but it also just totally immerses you. And in terms of immersion, Mike, this score,
Well, I mean, we, you know, I stole the joke from you in the first episode, so you could have it here if you want.
If someone filmed me brushing my teeth, it would be the most suspenseful movie of any other year, other than this movie. Listen, this score is much better than I gave it credit for, and it's much more nuanced than I gave it, more complicated than I gave it credit for in the last podcast, because I kind of just mentioned the ticking clock. I alluded to the ticking clock coming into this one. Hans Zimmer's going off, man.
Balls to the wall.
The ticking clock is kind of like maybe the, I don't know, music, but the the melody, the whatever. Anyway.
The metronome of it.
Yeah, the metronome. Okay, yeah. You know it a little bit.
You work on GarageBand.
Anyway, but that's just the base. That's just the foundation for this score. It is much better upon rewatches of this movie. I did like two over the last few weeks here where I want to listen to this now on Spotify. And I think I was saying, I made the joke that the Dunkirk score was only good to listen to while you're working if you're like defusing a bomb.
Yes.
That's a good joke.
Yes, you did say that.
That's a good joke. I liked it. And I hope you did. This score actually does have some legs for me, and I'm going to listen to it. If you're a college student and you got a deadline for your next paper.
Yeah, but it might also stress you the hell out and you like start pulling your hair
but
out.
But you should be.
You can't handle the pressure.
Don't procrastinate out there, college students. Get ahead of your schoolwork. But if you need, you know, you want to be a freaking hero, you want to be a beast, and you want to get that paper done, maybe listen to Hans Zimmer's soundtrack for this movie.
Not only the soundtrack, you can't say enough about it. It's basically perfect. I think I gave it a 99 if I was ranking that alone. But
yeah, I mean, the best production value, it's got to be the score.
Yeah, it's not close. But I mean, I just want to touch on...
Yeah, we talked about the visuals are great, but yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be the score. The one thing I want to touch on with sound, though, is that the movie does such a great job of manipulating you, and like you are feeling so claustrophobic and so scared and so dread-filled and
yes,
gloom and doom that like when you hear a bomb going off in the distance, it's gotten to the point where like, okay, we're safe for now. You know, so those guys over there are dead, but at least it's not coming here. And right, again, those scenes where you mentioned where the bullets are flying by, the bombs start off in the distance and they get closer and closer. I mean,
a lot of the promotion
This manipulation by audio in this is crazy.
Absolutely. A lot of the promotional interviews, which are really cool to listen to, they mention that, you know, war is a lot of monotony. And then, of course, running for your life and fight or flight.
Yeah.
I guess that's true. But I tell you, that exists in this movie to a degree. And it is one of those nonstop suspenseful. But they do have the pauses that the audience need. And you give them
catch your
a
breath.
Breather, yeah. Right? You give them that breather. And again, the music really does a lot to tip off when the suspense is going to ramp back up. Sometimes he does it, you know, he dukes you. He doesn't give you the music. And then you get the torpedo. You get the gunshot. You get the bomb. You get something that shocks you. And I don't think those are very vague spoilers. But yeah, those are the production values. We're going to get into the performances now, Mikey.
Yeah, but, you know,
you can't stop talking about the technicals.
But what is there to talk about the performances? I mean, there's some, it's tough to grade performances because there's not a whole lot to go on. Cillian Murphy plays a guy that's found at sea that doesn't want to go back to the war, even though that's where Mark Rylance is headed with his boat. I mean, Tom Hardy does all of his, I don't think he says a word in this whole thing.
Honestly, I think it's, he does. But I mean, it's quality stuff, over quantity. And I'm rooting for this movie at the end of the day, I think. I think the pros are going to come out in droves and
I hope so. I hope so, at least for the directing. But
listen, like, Mark Rylance is great, and he really puts on a clinic of serving the scenes early, and then when he gets the chance to go nuts, he does it in the climax scene.
Yeah.
He does it in a scene where does he go help this person or does he not go help this person? That's when he blows his actor top. You know, and I'm just so impressed with him there. All these characters are heroic to a certain degree, or not. I won't say which, but they're definitely given that choice of fight or flight. And
I'm just realizing like how true that statement you just said is. Like, how many times you're presented with fight or flight because you're on the edge of your seat, not only with the battle and the bullets and stuff flying by, but like, you know, Cillian Murphy makes a choice at some point, and then a choice has to be made about him. And it's like, what's going to happen? And again, that fight or flight thing that you allude to. There's a whole, whether it's done through audio or done through dialogue or done through, you know, the feeling of war. It's just, you're on the edge of your seat for this whole movie.
In drama schools, and of course in writing schools, you know, in film school, you're taught to put your characters in jeopardy, right? You're taught to give them a crucible in terms of the drama, which is just a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. And this movie is the epitome of that lesson that Nolan learned very early on. Listen, Tom Hardy's performance should win every Hollywood award for mass performance that we need to come up with.
Yeah, he's the greatest masked actor of all time.
Yeah, I mean, this man pulls off some of the most heart-wrenching catharses multiple times in terms of the decisions he has to make on screen for us by just where his eyes are looking. By the sense that, you know, he'll heave and take a deep breath. I can't get over what this man does with so little of his quote unquote instrument, being involved.
And the allegory of the thanklessness of war dealt through his character alone. By the end of the, you see what he goes through the whole time, and without giving anything away, at the end of the movie, where he ends up, it's just like, oh, Jesus.
But I mean, I've rewatched this movie a bunch of times, and to notice the subtleties of what some of these actors are doing, it's pretty incredible. I mentioned a few weeks back, Murder on the Orient Express. You can just see the difference between great acting and then people who are just kind of, reacting to other people. But you could see these actors are aware of the camera. They're doing all these subtle little things for you, put up, blown up on IMAX, they're even more exposed. But I tell you, I can't think enough of some of these veteran actors and what they're doing, from Branagh to Rylance. But yeah, you have Styles. You have a debut from Styles, and I thought he did a nice job. I'm surprised.
I got to tell you,
he got that role.
I had no problem with him in this movie, and I thought it was just a casting decision to get butts in the seats that you wouldn't see the movie otherwise. But I thought he was, he didn't blow your balls off, but he was very, very good.
Reserved. We'll tease Harry Styles' role for now, but for spoilers. So if you haven't watched Dunkirk, watch it, then come back to us. So we got Harry Styles. He's the selling point, right?
Yeah,
we got Harry Styles.
Great
Styles.
Hair.
Yeah, anyway, listen, to finish up.
E. Styles. That should be his name.
Great joke.
Thank you.
Great joke. That was I'm going to be like Conan O'Brien. That's the funniest joke I ever heard. I thought the rest of the cast did a great job, like I said, in terms of supporting cast. But,
I will say you're higher on the performances than I am. I mean, I think the Tom Hardy stuff is out of this world. But
I also watch this every single night.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of it.
Over the last month.
And you've been able to nitpick it more multiple times a day.
I'm freaking out like a crazy.
So I got to buy a remote controlled plane and just fly it by your ears every once in a while.
Drone. I got a twitch in my eye. Yeah, like someone who's did LSD or something, looking around the room for.
Which, again, let's say this. We said this in Black Hawk Down as well. We are not the landmark to judge how soldiers act in war, right?
Oh, absolutely not.
They are much better people and braver people than us, and we recognize that, and we're only commenting on the
littlest noise bump in the night would just destroy us as people. But that's the thing. You get Fionn Whitehead, who really looks like the kids I work with at a high school every day. Fionn Whitehead is the perfect vulnerable subject.
Get that look in his eyes. That he's in over his head, but he has to keep trudging forward.
It goes back to formula of a great monster movie. In Jurassic Park, that movie is not great without the two kids on tour with, Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum and Laura Dern. It's not the same movie if you don't have vulnerability. That's why you got a scream queen for every horror movie in the 80s, for every slasher movie. But yeah.
That's why?
Fionn Whitehead's a great example of this. Kenneth Branagh is both great at times, and he also has the worst lines of the movie. I'm gonna finish with Kenneth Branagh here, because after spoilers, after spoilers, I want to talk about Kenneth Branagh's hateful two lines. Harry Styles, more to come. Which you want to say, watch or don't watch? I think I'm going to say watch.
Yo, you don't say. What a shocking revelation.
TikTok of the clock.
Watch. I said, I asked you before, I think it's a great holiday movie. The fact that it's on demand, just came out on demand, is it makes sense. I think if you got to kill time over the holidays, we talked about those Netflix movies you wanted to watch with your family on Thanksgiving.
This is time that'll go by fast.
Yeah, you're going
to
be in
the
house.
You missed the worst dad joke of the podcast so far that you didn't respond to.
What was that?
That I said the TikTok of the watch or don't watch. That was the worst dad joke ever. Oh, I didn't see that.
That's bad. That's bad. Yeah.
That was the baddest dad joke. Oh, my God.
I was just yearning for the days of the mole still.
Couldn't get past. I didn't hear a thing that I freaking said.
I'm sorry.
Listen, Oscar reel scenes. I forgot Oscar reel scenes and best worst scene. We're going to, for me, the best and worst scenes I wanted to talk about in spoilers anyway. The Oscar reel scenes, the aerial battles, I think visual effects, either this or Star Wars. I think a lot of the technical categories, it's either this, Star Wars, maybe Blade Runner, maybe Shape of Water. And Oscar reel scenes, I mean, this movie's as tight of a script as you can get. So Oscar reel scenes happen from start to finish. I think you're going to look at the sights of this movie as really being an Oscar.
This contention. Is an Oscar. I mean, this is one of those we talk about all the time. You watch it, you come out of the theater, you think that's an Academy Award movie. It's an Oscar movie. And my best scene I have highlighted is actually Tom Hardy's last scene, what happens with his character, so we'll talk about that in spoilers.
Yeah, now cue the beat, man.
And yeah, let's get into it. Let's go into that German techno nightclub.
Fist pumping.
Spoiler time. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
Hope you enjoyed that interlude, as I know I always do when we put it out there.
I love that song.
It's the spoiler section for Dunkirk. Mike, and Oscar Sprint profile of Dunkirk. If you're looking for anything else about the movie Dunkirk, you have come too far. If you don't want spoilers, go ahead and head back. Listen to the first 50 minutes or so of this podcast. We'll fill you in on everything you need to know, but on the other side, we are here with spoilers. Let's talk about the ending and the twists and turns of the movie Dunkirk.
Yeah, some immediate carryovers from our non-spoiler section. Three things. Best worst scene, Kenneth Branagh's two punchlines, and Harry Styles. To start, Harry Styles, man, I'm surprised he was like the coward role that...
Yeah, I'm not surprised that he would take it, because I think he's too young to know the difference in branding right now, but I'm surprised that his handlers would allow him to be so vulnerable in such a major motion picture.
He was the coward. He was kind of the antagonist to Fionn Whitehead for a while there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good role for him.
He's got more of an arc than a lot of these characters, because he goes from coward somebody who, you know, realizes that, you know, his own faults and, you know, by the end, in a way.
True.
He's grateful to the other character and his survival. He also says the line of the movie at the end, going through the supply line where they're giving him food and blankets, and the guy's like, "Well done, lads." And he's like, "What are you talking about? We just survived." And that's enough. That's enough.
And that's what plays into my best scene as well, which I guess we can kind of transition to. But
jump in.
It's not only, I mean, we talk about the cinematography and the technical aspects, like you said, they're so great, so well done. The directorial stuff is beautiful. Everything about this movie is so tight. But what I left the theater most with was the impact that, again, we can't relate to it. We haven't been in there, but the impact of your impression of what these soldiers must have gone through. They don't understand really what's good. Like you said, Harry Styles is just happy to be alive and he's being treated like a hero.
Right.
And he can't understand that. My best scene was Tom Hardy going through this firefight, you know, in the air for an hour plus, getting saved, crashing into the, you know, I mean, and he crashes on the beach at the end, and he's taken at gunpoint by the enemy, and it's so thankless. It's just part of the job. He's a prisoner of war now, and it's like, man, after all that, he can't win. And I know winning and loss in war is relevant. It doesn't, I mean, it's irrelevant, I should say. It's a matter of perspective, but it's like, man, these guys can't get a break.
That was also my favorite storyline, no question about it. My best scene will come a little somewhere else, but I tell you, that my favorite storyline, and you see it three times. You see every one of Tom Hardy's kills three times. One with Tom Hardy, you see it with the Sikh storyline, and then, well, I guess you see it two times early, and then when Fionn Whitehead's mole storyline comes onto the sea at the very end, you will see one of Tom Hardy's shots and kills of the enemy dive bombers three times. So, yeah, I mean,
and he's the reason that, I mean, he's a big part of why they're able to get out of there. I mean, they do. And that's the end of this movie. The context to tell you about it is that they think they're only going to save about 40,000 or one-tenth of the 400,000 army.
Right.
They end up saving a lot more. doing no small part to Tom Hardy's actions in the sky, taking out two dive bombers.
I got all the stats for you on that. So I'm going to hit on the real history in a minute. Before that, though, the last of our immediate crossovers from the non-spoiler section is that Kenneth Branagh's two punchlines, home, and then the same thing again when all... And it's such a great moment. It's a goosebump moment.
I'm more forgivable of these than you are, but yeah.
It's a goosebump moment, dude, where... you're almost, if you're going to cry at the movie, this is where you cry at the movie.
I don't cry. I'm a man. I have testicles.
My worst scene of the movie should have been the best scene because it's perhaps the most emotional moment of the movie when the civilian boats come to the beach to, like you said,
certainly
instead
the
of 40,000, 300,000 get off that beach. You have Kenneth Branagh's line, and it's not Kenneth Branagh's fault because that man can, you know, carry any line through. But because he said home before, I could see home, and now he sees all the boats coming over.
Yeah, but that's for the people that went to buy popcorn and, you know, they went to see the movie on a whim without knowing the history.
The Capitol building and departed. It's so bad.
Yeah, it is. It's the Hollywoodism of...
Two towers at the end of Munich... Yeah.
It is. You're not wrong. It's on the nose as anything.
It's terrible, and it's the same
I'm more forgiving of it than you are.
And
You're right, though. It is probably the worst scene because this movie is so great otherwise.
It's freaking redundant. I know that's the point, the repetition, right. But it's so redundant because you don't have enough dialogue in this movie. I just hate
it. It's a fair point. I mean, it's, you know, the fact that you're using dialogue so sparsely and then you're being on the nose as you are with that. But I'm more forgiving in the aspect that the dialogue, and I said this in the non-spoiler section, the dialogue that is used so effectively otherwise.
Wow.
I can be more forgiving of that. But yeah. It's tough for me to say, you know, worse scene. I know I cop out about these movies way too much with saying there's no worse scene, but it's tough to say in something like this there's a worse scene.
Super tight.
I mean, it's really well done. It's short. It's succinct. It's... Good God, does it give you an anxiety attack at like eight different parts? The directorial choices and that he weaves together through three different time periods, but you're able to follow them so easily without much struggle as to keep up who's doing what and where it's happening. Credit in the world to Christopher Nolan. He deserves it. Credit in the world to Tom Hardy for pulling off being an Academy Award winning performance with just his eyes. Best eyes on an actor, I guess he would win.
No, that's my favorite part of the movie. Yeah. When Tom Hardy... makes the decision of whether he goes back to base. He looks, he stares at his fuel gauge, and it's my best scene. And he, you know, he looks out the top of his mask, then he looks down, and then his eyes go in another direction. Hey, I am going to continue fighting. That scene actually plays out a few different times, like I said, and it plays out on the beach in the climactic moment. And Tom Hardy, you know, wins the day. You have the epilogue with him, and you know,
so
from the finale to the epilogue, I just love the catharsis that he pulls off with just his eyes in that moment to stay fighting.
So what makes his character, and I know this is a tough question to ask because one's a moment in time and the other one's based on a life story, but what makes his character different from, you know, you're on the record of saying Billie Jean King in Battle of the Sexes is too perfect and too, you know, holier than thou. And Tom Hardy, obviously, is that, you know, he's basically the manly man that does the manly man decisions, for lack of a better term.
In terms of scene construction, right? You know, inciting incident, progressive complications, climax, crisis climax resolution, his fault is shown by the inciting incident. He is thinking that I have to go back. I have to run away from this fight. I'm posed with a dilemma that opens the scene. Fight or flight, save those men or not save those men. And then he looks at his fuel gauge. That is the screenwriter, Nolan, saying this is the inciting incident. I'm posing this dilemma of the overall scene, of the overall movie, fight or flight, because it actually comes back being, you know, the fighter, you know, the saving grace for everybody on the beach, the 300,000 on the beach, okay, or the probably 100,000 on the beach at that moment, well, 50,000 anyway. You have that programmed into the scene, the progressive complication of his eyes looking all over the place. And obviously he is, and this is in like 30 seconds, by the way, but that is a scene in its own right because he is debating what he should do. He's posed with the crisis, fight or flight, and he decides in the climax of that 30-second scene to keep fighting, and he doesn't care if his fuel runs out. He is going to fight to the death or to the
capture. So what makes that different from... from the Billie Jean King character, someone like that who's too perfect and too does too many of the right things.
It shows his flaws. It shows his vulnerability. It shows his human side at the beginning of that. His flaw, he wants to run. He wants to be not a coward, but he wants to run. In Billie Jean King, you don't have, I mean, you have like on-the-noseness, Dark Night of the Soul, where she just goes out and she's perfectionist, just hitting more tennis balls. Like, I probably have to watch Battle of the Sexes.
And they're different.
Again.
I mean, listen, I mean, it's a tough question.
I love Emma Stone in that movie.
It's a tough question to pose to you because they're two totally different aspects and two totally but different.
It's a good question to pose because you have, like I said, in bad war movies, you have unredeemable villains and you have, you know, infallible heroes. But this is not an infallible hero. This is Nolan showing soldiers who are on the run, right? This is not John Ford showing soldiers who are always on the attack and glorifying war. This is soldiers on the run. This is a story of an evacuation. You have Winston Churchill quotes being sent out there that I'm going to get into that says this is not a success. It shouldn't be looked at as a success at the time,
right,
being read by the characters from the newspapers that they're given. So I just think it's a great example of filmmaking and storytelling in tight spaces, which is, you know, we talked about the length of movies a lot of times being too long, and this guy pulls it off in a tighter space. You know, the old Thomas Jefferson quote, you know, I would write you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time, so I wrote you a long one.
Right.
You know, because again, it's harder to write a more concise, more well-structured piece than it is to write a long, meandering piece, e.g. every email I send to you. But listen, I wanted to get into the real history of Dunkirk. This is going to be my profile edition. Listen, Dunkirk is a commune in northern France, which I guess is the word for town in French. I don't know. And according to Wikipedia. Anyway, presently it has a population of 91.
I don't know chicken cordon bleu.
It presently has a population of 91,000. It's only 10 kilometers from the Belgian border, and the port overlooks the eastern part of the English Channel. The movie discusses and focuses on the evacuation of Dunkirk, codenamed Operation Dynamo, a.k.a., and has been known as since, the Miracle of Dunkirk. The evacuation lasted from May 26th to June 4th, only 7,000 soldiers were evacuated on day one. So essentially, this is boats, smaller boats
to
bigger boats.
Yep.
Basically, this is big boats docking, and they're able to get a few of them out. They're being dive bombed. They're being U-boated. Only 7,000 make it out. By the eighth day, 338,226 soldiers were evacuated. A fleet of 861 ships transported the soldiers to England. That included 174 naval ships, 43 of which were destroyers.
Wow.
So guess where the other ships are coming from? You have a variety of civilian and merchant ships. Again, that's 174 out of 861 were military.
I mean, this is the equivalent of like our troops being trapped at the Canadian border, being pinned down by North Korea,
right,
and then a bunch of people from like Washington, Oregon, and California taking their little, you know, yachts, their Sunday boats, and going up there and diving right into the battlefield to save these guys. It's unbelievable.
The majority of the fleet was composed of civilian and merchant ships, and also the majority of the losses involved civilian and merchant ships. That's something that's not necessarily portrayed in the film.
No,
it was more of just a colossal triumph, and like, you know, blanket triumph. But yes, in reality, more of, and I didn't want to really get into the stats on how many died, but 269 ships were sunk, only 34 of them.
I don't want to get into the stats of who died, but here they are.
Well,
to a man.
34 naval ships were sunk out of 269 sunken ships.
Only 34.
Churchill delivered his famous speech and call after the battle or the evacuation of Dunkirk, and called the overall fighting in Belgium and France within the speech a colossal military disaster. Again, it's referenced in the movie.
It's important to take from a nationalistic standpoint that, you know, I mean, because the movie, that part when they actually do escape, it's uplifting. It's happy.
Right.
It's given as a triumph. The townspeople are thanking them, praising them as heroes. But it's important to say the message, like, we got our asses kicked.
But you're given shades of gray. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, all these movies on-the-nose scripts, et cetera, that we've kind of lambasted over the history of our podcast tend to say one thing.
Right.
All right? And they tend to say one good thing about whatever, you know, the subject or the topic of the day, topic of the film is. This movie's saying 50,000 right. different things. A picture is literally worth 1,000 words. But to get into that Churchill quote, back to that, he said, "We must be very careful not to assign this deliverance the attributes of a victory. Wars are not won by evacuations." I think Harry Styles reads this.
This was Churchill or Gary Oldman?
This is same thing. I can't wait to see The Darkest Hour. We're looking forward to that.
We're going to have a Mike and Oscar sprint profile on The Darkest Hour soon.
Yeah. Backstory of why the evacuation took place, and this will be one of my final things on the profile here. It was the Battle of Dunkirk. A German panzer division wreaked havoc on the English, French, and Belgian forces to lead the charge and pin the Allied forces against the water. Now, the Allied forces were smart enough to get pinned on this uniquely defendable mole, like we said, this uniquely defendable port. So they were smart enough to let that happen. The German tank generals paused on May 23rd.
Which is this pausing is what you alluded to in the non-spoiler section.
The anniversary of the pause was the first day of principal photography in 2016. Yes, May 23rd, these German tank generals at the front lines of this charge paused because a lot of the terrain around the commune of Dunkirk was marshland, swampland. Obviously, you're getting close to the sea. So Hitler allows them to pause, and then a day later, Hitler orders them to pursue, and their tanks were decimated by the French, primarily French defenses. 30 to 50%, it's estimated. We don't know. They surge to the beach. It takes them a whole week to get through the blockades. But that allowed the Allied forces to barricade things up, and it also allowed basically Churchill to get the word out and start preparing the civilian fleet. Listen, the halt was one of the biggest mistakes by every war historian. That you can reference, one of the biggest mistakes Germany made on the Western Front.
Yeah, Hitler's got a couple of those to his resume.
As far as
going through Siberia and the pausing here, he's done a couple things that weren't. A
couple stories have been told
tactically
about that,
sound. Yeah,
about that man. Listen, over 98,000 soldiers were rescued directly from the beaches. Over 223,000 were taken from the harbor. Again, this was much more of a process than when depicted in the film. They kind of did this fast. They kind of made it into one moment. You know, that's storytelling right there. That's artistic license. But over 223,000 were taken from the harbor. So the ones who were taken from the beaches, little boats went to big boats, right? 98,000 of those. And from the harbor, a lot of big boats and a lot of small boats had to dock and had to get close to this.
The quick thinking, too. I mean, you go into, Mike Tyson, old quote. Here you are quoting Thomas Jefferson. I'll quote Mike Tyson, another poet of our time. It's, everyone's got a plan until they're punched in the mouth. The quick thinking to adapt on the fly, basically, to try and get, just save as many lives as you can because you've made your decision to pull out. You're getting the hell out of there. You're trying to go home. And there's a force, there's a monster in the dark that doesn't want you to do that. And the quick thinking to save all those lives is, my mind cannot possibly wrap around not only what the soldiers went through, but what the people in command must have been thinking at any time, at any point in war. And that's why these people are heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm going to finish up with my final thoughts, then we'll get into the grades. I love this darn script, man. I think I'm in awe of this thing. I love how the last hour of Tom Hardy replays during the sea storyline. A lot of the boats.
Yeah, the weaving of the three timelines is... Nolan has a lot of experience messing with timeline right. stuff, and so he's kind of become a master at it with Inception, Memento, and he shows it here, too. It's seamless.
The breathers and the pauses during the Fionn Whitehead mole storyline actually last, some of them last days. Something we saw in the movie Atonement took place at the beginning of the mm-hmm. Dunkirk scenario, and that was a lot of waiting around by the soldiers in that movie.
Yeah.
Kind of skip past quick, and this suspense movie adaptation of obviously the stories in Dunkirk from the real battle there. But yeah, I mean, those pauses took a while, and for him to interweave all three of those plot lines is nothing short of mastery.
Effortlessly. You're never mistaken where you are in time. Once you understand that this is three different timelines going on and they're three different paces, you know where you are at all times. And it's really, I mean, it's unlike, it doesn't get enough credit, I don't think, because it's unlike a lot of things that many directors would even attempt.
I will be shocked if Christopher Nolan does not win Best Director for this.
The technical aspect, I mean, it's just, it's mind-blowing how little love he's getting. I mean, and you read the Gold Derby stats, and I didn't know them going in. You said he's, you know, on the top five. He's on the top of nine lists, I think you said. He's on the top five of like 26 or something.
Right.
That gives me hope, because when I was reading these Critics Circle's Choices Awards, I was expecting to see his name so often, and it's just like, they're treating him like they're treating the Franco performance in Disaster Artist. We're like, yeah, it's cool, it's unique, so let's throw it a nomination, but it's not going to win. I think this is the top directorial performance of the year. If it's not Get Out, it's this.
Right. I think people are going to rewatch this movie a bunch. They're going to notice the subtleties that are being pulled off. They're going to notice the quality of each and every scene, the quality of each and every performance. Obviously, they knew from the IMAX experiences, from the theater experiences, the technical savvy and just the triumph of the technical aspects of this film. Like we said, we gushed for a while about the production values.
Yeah, this deserves the Mad Max Fury Road treatment, where Mad Max swept all the underneath stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the production design, the best score, best cinematography, you know, that's, I think, where this movie belongs.
But you don't have a Saturday morning cartoon script for this one. Like you did in Mad Max.
It's very serious.
You have Tom Hardy doing things with his instrument. But you
basically cast Tom Hardy, win Oscar. It seems to be the formula.
But I love the credit that this movie gives to its audience. It doesn't hold your hand. It does a lot of things for a big blockbuster film like we're going
to
say.
But again, I think that has to do with Nolan's directorial choices. I mean, it doesn't have to hold your hand because you don't have a problem following what's going on.
So the rewatchability just on the script analysis, story analysis alone is pretty awesome. Because
yeah, it's not the point of our podcast. We're not going to do a Christmas what you need to watch on Netflix or on demand over Christmas. But this is something, if you're over Christmas break and you're home and you got to kill a couple hours, you're with your girlfriend, boyfriend, loved ones, parents, put this on.
Yeah, for me, it's raised points every time. So to get into my grade, Michael, I have it as a 93A.
That's up there for you, huh?
It's up there for me. Again, I started out with a 90A- on my first viewing.
I remember.
Four viewings later, I'm now at an A, and I can't help myself.
Yeah, this movie's not without its warts for me. It's, again, the technical aspects. It's one of the I have my scores in front of me. My director, Nolan, his job, I gave a 95. The score I actually gave 100 to. I said 99 on the non-score. This is the greatest scored movie.
Man of Steel, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's what I was going to finish that sentence with.
Nolan produced a movie right there.
But I have it in the 88, 89 range, a solid B+ as an overall movie. High rewatchability. I'm a little harder grader than you are sometimes, but you're also the actual film student. I'm some schlub from the couch.
I'm a schlub as a film student as well.
Yeah, all right, easy. So that's where we're at. I mean, so you're saying a solid A-. I'm saying a B+, solidly in that range.
We both liked it.
You're getting exactly what you think you are with this movie. Again, my expectations were a little too high because, you know, coming off the Dark Knight trilogy and Inception and all that. But you're getting a Christopher Nolan war movie in under 2 hours with a Hans Zimmer score that's going to make you feel like you can fight monsters. You're getting Tom Hardy's, you know, beautiful baby blues staring right back into your soul for about an hour as he fights down German Kraut planes. And you're getting everything you could hope for with this movie to an extent, as long as you're not expecting the Dark Knight on a battlefield.
Yeah, it's not that. This is an exercise in cinema. This is a masterful exercise in suspense filmmaking. This movie is innovative in terms of its screenwriting. It's innovative in terms of what it does, technically speaking. It's a great movie, and it's a great composition as a whole. I think it's extremely strong. The quality is high. The bar is set very high. it is not like a timely movie in the sense that it's dealing with an issue we're facing present day, even though you can argue metaphorically. And
not timely, but ironic in that, you know, The Darkest Hour deals with some of the Dunkirk stuff. So we have two of those movies that are kind of side by side in award season.
It could fit, ironic. I guess, you know, again, you can make a lot of projections from real life to, you know, what this story says now for us and how it can inspire us today. However, you know, a World War II movie stacked up against the issue movies we have with Lady Bird, the issue movie we have with Get Out, you know,
Star Wars,
Call Me By Your Name. No. Yeah, Star Wars. You have great issue movies who are coming out. Are they of that quality that this movie is? This movie is an A slam dunk. Usually my Oscar grades for Oscar movies, like last year's Moonlight was like a 90 A-, 89 B+ all day, won Best Picture. Usually my winner of Best Picture is graded around a B+, A-.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a fair point.
So something to tease for our, you know, category reviews, and mm-hmm. something we're definitely going to talk about is this movie's rated extremely high for us.
This is a very Oscar, this is an Academy movie.
Can be something that gets overlooked. Does the Academy overlook the better movie for the better issue, for the more prominent issue? And I don't know. This is a great movie.
For me, as long as we're getting a cinematography, a score, and a director nomination out of this, I expect it to be nominated for Best Picture.
Right.
If it wasn't, I wouldn't be heartbroken, but
yeah,
I think the other three, because it's so into the other three categories, it needs to be in those other three. I would be more heartbroken if it wasn't there. But that said, if it does get those three nominations, I would expect it to get a Best Picture.
It's also getting the blowback from non-steak eaters, you know, where this is a steak eater macho movie.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that a macho movie shouldn't be recognized just because it's a macho movie. I don't want to see that knee-jerk reaction, even though, you know, all of cinematic history is, you know, led by the macho people. But that doesn't mean a great movie. But this is about the flight impulse. This is not, Tom Hardy brings the fight impulse to it.
You
but
could
the
see
flight
the inner battle that Mike is having now with himself.
Because, yes, it's more important to watch Lady Bird. It's more important to watch Get Out. It's more important to watch Call Me By Your Name. Those issues are more at the forefront, even though you can argue.
That's a very good point you're making. I mean, these, you know, are there going to be points deducted from it because it doesn't deal with harassment or gender equality issues, you know, stuff like that. It's, and who knows, maybe, and if it should, well, that's going to be something that history dictates us. I mean, you know, is there room in the Academy for war movies that are primarily male-based, primarily white male-based? Who knows? We're going to see.
I'm stoking a fire. I know I'm pitting people the wrong way with that. Now, last year, it wasn't the case for me. I thought of the Academy Award movies, you know, Moonlight, you could totally make the argument that it was a better constructed film than La La Land. Totally make that argument, even though I liked La La Land more because I'm a white person with white people problems and I don't understand the rest of the world in that regard.
Which is why I say, too, bubbled. I mean, if, you know, because it is a white movie, you know, there's white leads. White actors primarily, done by a white male director. You know, if it loses, I love the job that Nolan did, but if it loses to Jordan Peele, if it loses to Greta Gerwig, what are you going to do? You know, those movies deserve it just as much.
As much as I love Get Out, though, it's not a better movie than this one, I don't think. Love Lady Bird, to me, it's not a better movie than this. The heights of this movie are just way higher.
Whereas I can disagree with that, but that's you know,
that's a good debate.
We're gonna get those when we get to the Oscar previews.
We'll poke you all on Facebook. That's not happening.
I wish you would stop poking me. But that's it. That's our Dunkirk. That's our Oscar sprint profile review.
Substantial
spoilers, non-spoiler section, all in the books. You're not going to go wrong watching this movie. Whether you get hyped up for the awards that it might get on Oscar night, you know, we'll see. Like we always say, time's going to tell. But that's all we have for you as far as this episode goes. Be sure to go back, check out our other Oscar sprint profiles that we have. We're going to pop them out as much and as often as we can because we have a lot to get through, as we started this episode saying. You have anything you want to add in here? Or are we just going to call it?
I think my voice is almost lost.
All right. let's call it then.
I talked a lot in this one.
Yeah, you did, but that's the credit to you. This is one of your most beloved movies of the year so far.
Here's what I want to say. Home.
Cut. All right, guys, until next time, you know what we say. Reality sucks. Be sure to keep watching movies with us. You want to reach out to us? We want to hear from you. We are Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com. Hit us up. Give us a comment. You know, we love hearing from you guys. We're going to read them as much as and often as we can when we have the openings to.
We love to talk to other human beings about movies, yes.
Yeah. I mean, anyone that's not us would be nice to hear from.
I went to a movie with Mike yesterday.
Yeah.
And he just, it's like the people in front of us literally got up and left.
They were cowards.
Because Mike wanted to talk to me during the
they
whole movie.
They were cowards.
It was hysterical. Yeah, we like talking to each other about movies, folks. We're having a blast recording these episodes. We kind of did the history buff thing. We gave you a lot of, you know, media information about the subject, and we'll keep having fun recording these suckers.
Yeah, so keep on listening. Go with us. We're getting you through this Oscar sprint. That's our hope and our main concern, our worry.
It's our hope and our prayer.
Yeah, prayer. There you go. Like a prayer. Madonna. All right, guys. Check us out next time. We'll see you.